Welcome into Feel Good Life, the next episode with Dr. Tim Walker of Horizon Ag. Good morning, Tim. How are you today?
Jennifer, I'm good. It's good to see you and hope you're doing well.
Doing well. Could stand a little break in the heat, but in July and August in Arkansas, that's just part of the process, I guess.
Yeah. We're going to get a break, though. Looks like maybe this weekend. Going to get a little bit of break from the heat, I hope.
Yes, I hope so. Yeah, 80, the mid to the high 80s sounds enjoyable, actually, after some of the heat we've had here recently.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to start out by asking you to tell the folks who are listening who you are, kind of what you've done in your career and what you're doing now at Horizon Ag.
Sure, Jennifer. Thank you. So I entered into the rice business, I guess, back in the late 90s. People asked, how does a dairy farmer from the hills of Mississippi get involved in rice? And I like to tell everyone, well, I love lacrosse boots. I've worn them all my life. Lacrosse boots work great in the rice field. They work great in the dairy parlor. It was always the next, best thing. I was a student at Mississippi State, needed work, got involved in agronomy, doing some analytical analysis, and started applying to grad school. And the person in agronomy that I was working for said, hey, I mean, I'm getting these requests for you to, to go to grad school. Are you interested? And I'm like, yeah, want to pursue something. And he said, well, have you thought about agronomy? And I said, well, what do you have to offer? And so he had a rice project and, it gave me an opportunity to stay in Starkville. I was a transfer student, so I'd only been in Starkville a couple of years at that time. So, started working in rice, knew nothing much about it other than I ate it on occasion. But I was a chemistry major, and the fact that I could use some of the basic chemistry knowledge that I'd learned in production agriculture was a hook. I a multi-generation farming family, just not typical Delta row crop agriculture. So loved agriculture, been around it all my life, and rice was the hook that kept me in agriculture. So I pursued a PhD and ended up, after completion, I moved over to the Delta in Stoneville, spent about 12 to 15 years in the Mississippi State University system as an agronomist. And, kind of got to a point where there was that fork in the road. I had gone through all of the promotion steps through the university, and the university is really, really good about, if you've been a successful scientist, they typically want to put you in an administrative role. And I had been trained for that, but I just had fallen in love with the rice industry. And I was a member of the leadership class in 5. And so I was hesitant to get into university administration because I felt like it was going to take me further and further away from what I had really grown to be passionate about. And that was the rice, the people of rice, the rice industry as a whole, not knowing at that time that I was going to get a phone call from the ownership of Horizon Ag. And so it happened really, really quick. And, I took over the helm of Horizon Ag as CEO in 2014. And so we, moved from the Delta back to the hills. I live about 15 minutes from where I grew up, and I'm another 20 or 30 minutes from the office in Memphis. So it was, it checked a lot of boxes. I got to stay in rice. I got to move back closer to home and where I grew up on the family farm and all of that. So anyway, that's my story. Love rice. Love the fact that I, was able to cut my teeth on the industry in the university setting. I learned a lot. The rice leadership program certainly opened my eyes even more to what all this, awesome crop had to offer me individually.
So let's go back to the dairy farm, though. Still operational?
No. I was the baby boy. And so when I graduated high school, within a year, the dairy cattle had left the farm. We replaced the dairy cattle with beef cattle, and it remained operational as a beef and hay operation for an additional 10 plus years. And then we got out of the totally out of the cattle business. We were renting our hay land to a neighbor. And my girls, who's Leah and Kara, they're now, Leah's 19, getting ready to start her sophomore year of college. But they had grown up in the Delta. They were born in the Delta. I farmed a little, you know, patch of soybean. I had a crop of rice, some wheat there close to our home in Cleveland. And so they knew row crop agriculture. And so when we moved back close to the farm, I mean, row crop agriculture was out of the picture for us. And so I said one day, hey, girls, do you want some cows? And they were like, yeah, Daddy, we want cows. So we, my daughters and I, bought four females, red Angus females. And one of my daughters showed throughout her career and really enjoyed it. The other one showed a few times and said, Dad, this isn't for me. So, you know, you got to love cattle to fool with them. And so we've grown that operation. We have about 25 registered mama cows, and we sell some herd bulls and replacement females. And then we also, when COVID hit, a lot of people asked about beef. Hey, you got cows, you know? And I was like, well, the cows that I have really aren't for beef, but if that's what you want, we can do it. So we have started buying steers from bull customers of ours, bringing them back to the ranch and feeding them. So we sell feeder steers, fed steers, ready to, you know, for meat. And so, yeah, it's, again, agriculture's in my roots. And this is an opportunity for my kids to see and them have their hands in agriculture, albeit it's, you know, much smaller in scale than what I was used to growing up. But it has kept them connected to the land, to the family. So hopefully we're doing the right thing there.
Oh, I love that. That's a great story. I did not know that about you. So that's really cool to learn and to see you pass some of that prior generational type family farming, ranching down to your children too. I think that's really cool. It's something we all want to do for sure if we're in any kind of agriculture. So I'm sure to see them actually have an interest is makes you happy, makes you smile. So even if they don't end up there, you know, for long term. Right. So you're that's very right. diverse in your ag knowledge then. A little row crop and animal ag. Yeah. Animal ag scares me. It just sounds, like if you said two to three cows, I'm like, ooh, I'll take several thousand acres of rice over that. That sounds much easier to me.
That's the way most people are, you know, especially in what I call Delta agriculture, where, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of the farmers in the hill area, they diversify, they plant their bottom lands and row crops. And I think right now with the commodity situation, those people are probably doing pretty well because in case you haven't seen, cattle are at an all-time high. So I do think that is a saving grace for some of these smaller scale farmers that you know, have both cattle and row crops.
Yeah, definitely, being diversified any way we can is super important. As we all know, in agriculture it's extremely cyclical, and those beef farmers have been through a long struggle of high corn prices and high feed prices, so they're getting their fun times, which is good to see for those folks too. Out there
it is.
So talking about low commodity prices, you know, the rice industry obviously has been struggling, and we're seeing some changes in export markets, domestic markets. There's a lot to cover there. So let's kind of dive in on our exports and how we are competing. Who do we compete with as in southern rice production mainly, Tim?
Well, southern production, I would say most of that rice stays in the Western Hemisphere, whether it's domestic or exports. And exports are extremely important to the entire U.S. rice industry, but especially the South. And so our competition, I mean, when you think about our markets, you know, you have Haiti, for an example. They use a lot of milled rice, but then we export a lot of paddy rice to Mexico. You know, Central American countries, we have the trade agreement with Colombia. That's always, you know, Venezuela is kind of in and out. I mean, we know that there's political issues and things that go on there. So most of our rice does stay in the Western Hemisphere. But, you know, back, I'm going to say 20, 30 years ago, we kind of owned those markets. I mean, we were basically the only game in town. But as we all know from other crops, the Mercosur, and I use Mercosur, it represents Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, you know, a lot of those South American countries, as they, you know, continue to grow their industries, grow their infrastructure, they have become quite competitive in markets that we traditionally owned. And so when we talk about Mexico, our biggest market, and then some of those Central American countries grouped together would come close to rivaling Mexico, those are the markets that we're having challenges with, largely because of the competition from South America, from those Mercosur countries.
Is that strictly based on price, or are we talking type of rice, quality, all the above, I guess, somewhat?
It is all of the above. I mean, price, you know, people say it's quality or it's this or that, but you know, price does drive things. But quality is important. And, you know, I think if there's one thing that I could remind anyone that has an interest in listening about rice, you know, it's a great segue. We talked about my small cattle operation. You know, my cattle don't care what variety of corn it is or soybeans or whatever. Just, you know, just keep it in front of them and they'll eat it. Well, with rice, obviously, we have human, you know, consumption. And so, you know, each little area that consumes rice, they have their own particular things. I mean, we do that here domestically as well. I mean, when you think about rice that makes sushi versus rice that you would put, you know, in a gumbo or just strictly table rice, those are all different. They have different cooking characteristics. So all of that being said, you know, the customer is much more intelligent and they have the ability to say what they want and what they don't want. And the chemistry of our traditional Southern U.S. long grain is in fact different than the chemistry of the southernmost South American rice. And that chemistry dictates how that cooked form of rice, its texture, you know, how it cooks and the texture and the feel and the mouth and all of those sorts of things are dictated by that cereal chemistry. So we are competing not just with price, but we're also competing with products that are different than most of what we grow here in the southern United States. So it's kind of a double whammy right now for us.
And so what is that main difference? Not to get too deep in the chemistry part of it, but is it just stickiness? Is it?
Yeah. So the amylose content largely determines how sticky the rice is or how loose it is. So if you think about sushi rice, which is sticky, it's going to be, you know, stick together to hold all the ingredients inside the sushi, you know, California rolls or whatever. That's low amylose rice. So it has a very low content of amylose. And then you go to the opposite of extreme, which is what South Americans grow. They want, when they're eating rice, they want those grains to be individual. They want to be able to feel every grain that enters their mouth. And I know that's very different from our culture because we typically don't eat just a lot of table white rice. It's usually in a soup or a gravy, you know, gumbos and things like that. Right. So we just don't care as much about it as people who eat, you know, rice three times a day. We think about our consumption in the United States, you know, it's 20 to 25 pounds and a lot, you know, probably 10 to 15, 20% even is beer.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're drinking it, you know, so, but these people are eating 150 pounds of rice or so a year.
My gosh, really that
so,
much
yes,
more? That is
absolutely
crazy.
It is three times a day, desserts, everything revolves around rice. So yeah, so I mean for a farmer here in the southern United States to think about where his product is destined, I think it does do us, you know, good for us to truly understand who that customer is and what he wants. And it's quite different than our society.
Well, and I think most people here, even myself, I think of Asian sticky rice. I think that most people would like it to be sticky. And, you know, for the most part, that's not where Southern rice is going, not to those markets. And so
absolutely,
I think that's an interesting topic to kind of to bring out. So when you talk about AMRO's content, where do we fall in there? We're obviously not sushi rice, but we're not completely separate kernels either, are we? It doesn't seem like it.
Well, the true definition of Southern U.S. long grain rice, it would have an intermediate level of amylose. So we're going to be somewhere around 20 to 23%, maybe 24% amylose content. And so that rice is still, though it's not as sticky and clumpy as a short grain or medium grain that's used for, you know, Asian dishes or what have you, it's still sticky relative to something that we're competing against that is a minimum 26%, could go as high as 30%. If Jennifer, if you've ever eaten parboiled rice, and you know how loose that is,
yes,
just imagine that that is what they prefer on their tables, but they do not prefer it being parboiled. I said a long time ago in some of my early trips into Latin America, you know, when they were talking about how loose they wanted, I said, well, we got that fixed, just parboil it. But the color of parboiled rice would turn those customers off, because they buy that rice with their eyes. If there's rice in the grocery store packaged in a opaque container, that's going to be the cheapest rice. They're covering stuff up, okay? The people there, they want a translucent bag so that they can really look at the rice, you know, so it's looks and cook. I think cook is going to trump the looks, but they do buy a lot of rice with their eyes. And so, yeah, that's another issue that we fight with respect to quality.
Well, I think in America, we're not looking at the kernels of rice in the bag. We might be looking at the name on the bag, trying to buy, you know, Arkansas rice or Louisiana rice or California rice, wherever you're closest to, whichever market
right.
you're trying to support. But most people probably are not looking and saying, oh my goodness, there's a Morning Glory, or there's a coffee bean in that bag, or there's some chalk on those grains, or they're broken, or, you know, not as long as I think they should be, and all those things. We're not as a discerning rice customer here in the U.S. as a lot of these countries, like you say, who are eating 150 pounds a year per person,
exactly.
which is a lot. We could stand up our consumption here a little bit. We got some room to grow.
Yeah, I would love to see it. You know, I would love to see growth. The French fry is just hard to overcome,
well,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, know, yeah.
It has its place, right? So speaking of domestic consumption, we are seeing some pretty huge increase, in my opinion, in imported rice into the United States, predominantly being the aromatics, and I'm assuming out of Thailand and India, you know, jasmine and basmatis. We, as a rice farmer, I have been growing jasmine-type rices for quite some time now. As, you know, as soon as some of the universities in the South were trying to find varieties, you know, we were trying to find some to grow as well. And I think Horizon has kind of tiptoed into that market here in the last several years as well. So let's talk about some aromatic rices in this domestic consumption.
Well, Jennifer, to your point, the amount of rice that we bring into the country is astounding. You know, it used to make up, you know, maybe 10%. Nowadays, we're importing, I would dare say this year, when the marketing year closes and all the numbers are reported, we will import almost as much rice as we export. And that's a tremendous problem for our rice industry. We know we're never going to have 80 million acres of rice in the United States like corn or soybean. So we're going to be a small crop. But when you start bringing rice, you know, into the country that takes away from stuff that we can grow here, it is a warning sign for our industry. But because we need technology in rice, whether it's herbicide, new herbicide technology, any type of pest management technology, well, you need the acres. You know, these companies need the opportunity to recoup their expenses of developing and marketing these products. And so when you start seeing this much outside pressure, coming in, it is a serious problem. And a lot of people don't know, but when you break down the amount of rice that we bring into the country on an acre basis, it is takes Louisiana, maybe even Louisiana and Texas, that what they would produce on an annual basis, that's how much rice we're bringing in. And so we have acres that aren't being planted to rice that could be planted to rice, but, you know, we unfortunately, we're bringing that type of rice in, or that quantity of rice in, and not taking full advantage of growing it ourselves. And so you mentioned Horizon getting into the aromatic market. We do have one variety that is aromatic. CLJ01 is the variety. It was developed at LSU, and it was probably one of the first varieties in modern times that really got pretty close to the imported Thai jasmine rice. It's a beautiful kernel, very translucent and shiny, and grain length's good and aroma's good. So during COVID, you know, when the world stopped, you know, we had these domestic users of aromatic rice that suddenly said, hey, we can't get this rice, or it's costing us too much to ship, you know, can we do it here? And so we were aggressive, you know, in our approach to get the seed multiplied. And since then, it's been sort of up and down. Some years it seems like we have good markets, and in other years we don't. But I would love to see a move of the industry, whether it's politically or what have you, you know, put into place some sort of protection for opportunities for the U.S. rice farmer to take advantage of this. Because a lot of people, I mean, we've always had this dialogue of paddy rice export versus milled rice. And, you know, unfortunately, we just don't have the markets for milled rice. So the fact that we're growing over 2 million acres of rice a year, a lot of that is because we do have some paddy markets that help us, you know, move the rice. But you're talking about a fix for some paddy. The whole paddy versus milled conversation, if we started growing into that market that we're importing, that's a milled market. You know, we would grow it here, we would mill it here, and how great that would be, you know, for our local economies that are heavily driven by the rice crop. So,
well, and I've always just asked the question is, most Americans who grew up here eating Southern long grain rices, we aren't as discerning as we talked earlier about rice. And so why do you think that an American jasmine rice consumer is not choosing an American jasmine?
That's a good question. And I don't, you know, I'm just going to tell you my opinion. So I'm certainly subject to be fact checked here. Jennifer, I'm still astounded. I mean, there's people that travel more than me, but I do travel a fair amount. And oftentimes, you know, sitting on the airplane or whatever, we strike up conversation and, you know, it ultimately gets to, well, what do you do? Where are you going? And it comes out, I'm in the rice industry. I'm going to do whatever with rice. We grow rice here? I didn't know that. And, you know, and we're flying out of Memphis, which is, you know, you're flying over 1.5 million acres not long after takeoff if you're going west. And so, yeah, it's just astounding the number of people that still don't know that we grow rice here in the United States. And, you know, I'll just, again, put this plug in. I think you've teed it up well. Not only do we grow rice, but there's no doubt with our standards of safety and all of that, we grow a sustainable product. It's extremely safe. And some of the same standards that we're upheld to in the production, I don't know that we're upholding that rice that's coming into the country to the same standards. There's all sorts of stories of why we should be demanding U.S. rice first. But, you know, and I have seen momentum in small segments of other commodities or food stuffs. You know, I know the seafood industry and Mississippi, it's very important now in the Gulf, and they've just recently passed legislation that they have to, you know, show whether it's U.S. seafood or foreign seafood. And so there are other industries that are being hurt by imported food, but right now, at least from what I know in the rice industry, it's pretty much a wide open game, you know. So
yeah, right. Well, and in these other countries that are reliant on rice, that it is the three meal a day plus dessert food type, you know, or cuisine or whatever you want to call it, rice on the table. They're eating a lot more rice, and their governments are protecting their markets because it is an extremely important food in those countries. And so we eat so many different types of foods in America, and we can produce so many different types of foods that politically it does make it difficult to begin to segment out and things like that. So it's not an easy fix, except for anybody who is listening to us talking today should always turn a bag of rice over and make sure that it has the grown in the USA label on there, because I think most people who are selling rice here that are buying rice from U.S. farmers are putting that logo on their packages. And I think it's really important because there is a tremendous amount of imported rice just on my grocery store here in rural eastern Arkansas, which is surprising and maddening at the same time.
Right. Yeah. And so, again, I think we have to broadcast ourselves. If you're involved in the rice industry or care about food, you know, I think rice is a interesting conversational piece. You know, if you're on the plane or, you know, you're at the local store or whatever, you know, just talk about the importance of rice, that we do grow it. We grow it sustainably. We grow it, you know, it's you know, heavily regulated in terms of the products that we can use. And so I have to tell her story,
right.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it is a neat story. It's a neat crop.
And usually it gains a lot of attention when you get someone on the topic that's not familiar with the rice industry, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So you mentioned a little bit about regulation, and earlier you were talking about we are a small crop, and therefore it's expensive to get new varieties released, new technologies, new chemistries of herbicides and other crop protection products for the rice industry in Arkansas. And I'm sure you're familiar with that from the seed background. So talk a little bit about, you know, those challenges and difficulties to get new things to the market in the rice industry.
Jennifer, I was on the phone most of the morning talking about different diseases that we have in rice and that are no longer being controlled, or certainly not being controlled as well as by the products that we have as they once did. But as you look back, I mean, we really haven't had a new fungicide to use in rice in my whole career, which is 25 plus years. You know, they remix them, they put something else with them or whatever, but they're the same products. And you start, you know, the farmers start saying, well, why can't we get a new fungicide? I mean, we've had this for 30 plus years. And it really came to light. I was at a meeting a couple of years ago, and there was an individual with a basic manufacturer, and they were talking about the expense of developing and registering a new crop protection product, and the number was like $300 million that he quoted. And so if you think about that type of investment in a crop like rice, where we only have 2 to 2.5 million acres of rice, maybe 3 million in a big year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that company only has so much time where the patent is going to protect them. They've got to be able to recoup and then make their net margin numbers that these investors and, you know, are doing it. So it's just the because of regulation and things like that, it is just a huge cost that they've got to bet on being able to recoup those costs and then make, and compare that to corn and soybeans, you know, 80 plus million acres a year individually for those crops. It's just it's an easier bet to put your resources into those bigger crops on new products and things. And then the water. I mean, you know, we grow rice in an aquatic environment. So then that brings in another level of regulation that we have to deal with. And so when you talk about the aquatic environment, small acres is just quite costly to register new products, you know, but we desperately need them. We desperately need them. Yeah. It is. It's just so helpless to go out. And I still, though it's much smaller than it used to be, I still walk some fields each year and, you know, look at some problems and things like that. And it is so helpless to go out and, you know, see a guy that's where we may have sheath blight that's blown up and it's costing him yield. And he's told you, you know, I've sprayed this product, you know, everything's done the way it should be done. But, you know, that fungus has, you know, done what Mother Nature does. I mean, over time it builds resistance and so it's no longer working. And then for me not to be able to say, well, hey, don't use this product anymore, go to this one, you know, and there's none of that with some of the diseases that we're fighting. There's no go to another product. It's, you know, we've got what we've got, and that is a very helpless feeling, you know, because there's a lot of investment in making the crop for those one or more pests that we just simply don't do a good job controlling, to know that they're going to ultimately eat away what little bit of profit opportunity we have.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're talking about $300 million, you know, that's not going to come from a small private company or a university system. You know, we're talking large corporate.
Yes. Multinational.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, we're relying on folks making decisions for their margins and their profits. And of course, we're down at the bottom of the list when that comes to into play.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what about Horizon Ag? What's on the future for Horizon Ag?
Well, Jennifer, thank you for asking that. I mean, we certainly, we've got our challenges as an industry, but we are excited about Horizon Ag. We're excited about the future. You know, for a long time, Horizon was basically in the seed marketing business. You know, we've gotten more and more involved at different times, but probably one of our biggest investments for the long term is when we chose to get into the variety development business ourselves. So we greatly appreciate the opportunity that we've had for so long to work with the universities, and we will continue to work with the universities. And I think the unique thing about us getting into rice breeding was the partnership that we developed with LSU. You hear a lot of university folks talk about funding and it's a challenge, but I do think, you know, there are opportunities for public-private partnerships. And this idea I had pitched, you know, probably 10 years ago, because I came out of the university system. I knew some of the challenges that all universities were having. And so I was like, hey, we can do this now. But It took a different mindset, you know, for some university administrators. And fortunately, LSU had some leadership changes and an individual came in, was a little bit more, I guess, open-minded to the public-private partnership. And, you know, we were able to hire a very, very good rice breeder, you know, had experience. She's from Argentina, so she understands this quality thing quite well. But Maria Montiel joined us in May of last year upon finishing her PhD, and she is domiciled at the Ag Center in Crowley. But we have, you know, a separate breeding program, but she is working, you know, with the LSU program. We continue to support, you know, the University of Arkansas breeding program and, you know, continuing to look and find ways to work as close as we can. I just think that, again, we've talked about the smallness of our industry. And so I think that anywhere that we can partner, we're better. When it becomes just a straight competition in an industry that's so small, I like partnerships. I like finding mutual beneficial relationships where we can, I just feel like we can accomplish more with, to be quite honest, less money. Why are we all spending money on the same thing in an industry that's already struggling, you know, to see how many dollars can actually be put into towards a problem. So we like it. So I think what it shows the industry, I hope, is that we're committed. We're committed to continuing to grow and find a place. I mean, we've been involved in these conversations regarding some of the issues that we have with markets. We've been involved in that for so long that it was a breath of fresh air for me once we were able to pull off this deal, this agreement, and get Maria on board, that I'm now more in control of how we go about providing solutions. It's not just sitting back, you know, asking people for solutions and, you know, yeah. we're much more in control of how we can contribute to solutions as opposed to just talking about the various problems. So I'm very excited about that. I mean, Horizon's grown. You know, when I came to Horizon, we were, I think, about four people strong, and we've tripled that. I mean, our partnerships are still, I mean, we're partnered with retail, we're partnered with seed producers. Partnership is one of our core values. We're never going to get away from that. But we have, you know, we had to respond to some things in the industry and take a little bit more ownership along the way. But it's been good changes. Change is never easy. But we've done the best that we can to manage the change that was necessary. And I think we're reaping some benefits from those changes, not just us individually, but I do think our industry is reaping some of those benefits as well.
Well, and, you know, the quality issue in the rice industry has been a topic for a very long time. And it seems like we're kind of coming to a head with that and breeding programs like what you're talking about, certainly, I'm sure, are moving to try and address those issues as best they can. But it just takes so long. I mean, from a initial cross to where you have some decent material to even start looking at is, what, 7 years, 6-7 years minimum?
It is, Jennifer. I mean, you know, it just, breeding takes time. And so decisions that we're making today, you know, you won't see the fruit of that, as you said, for 6 or 7 years. And so it is a long game. And especially with some of the problems that we're challenged with today, we're having to integrate new germplasm. And anytime you do that, you know, people always talk about a yield drag if a new technology, you know, like a new herbicide tolerant technology comes out. Well, it's the same thing. And, you know, can you get there? Do we have the tools that help speed things up? Yes. But, you know, when you're crunched from, you know, you need a new technology, but the farmer needs yield, he needs performance, it is a challenge. But I think we're making a lot of progress. And look, you know, we at Horizon with our breeding program, certainly we do have a focus on quality, but that's not to take away from what the universities have been doing for a long time. And, you know, our university programs they saw some of these quality issues coming up, and we're not starting from ground zero. There are things out there that, you know, are either already entered into the market or certainly coming in the next few years that can help us in this battle against, you know, markets, whether it's the loss of exports or increasing imports. There's a lot of good things out there. A lot of work's been going on, you know, just probably hasn't been talked about a whole lot. So,
well, we're going to get there. We're certainly going to get there. One last thing I want to talk about before I let you go is the rice leadership class, because I believe currently they are taking applications for the new class that'll be interviewed and named in December at the Outlook Conference in New Orleans. And I've been through it. It's fantastic. You've been through it. That's probably where we met, was when you came through. It was our first meeting, was probably when you guys were here in Arkansas. So tell us a little bit about your experience in that program.
Jennifer, like I said earlier, I mean, it was a game changer for me in terms of my entire career, because once I went through that program and built relationships that then fostered other relationships, you know, it just got to the point where these were my people. I mean, the rice people are my people. It got to that point. And so it wasn't just a job, you know, it became the culture for me and my family, to be quite honest. So, you know, the exposure of the industry and seeing all of the different things that go on to make it happen, the relationships, the driving countless miles in a van, and the conversations that happen, you know, at all hours of the day and night. So, you know, I still have vivid memories, you know, and I was in the class 20 years ago. But since then, matter of fact, I guess I can say it, I've just been selected to go to the Mercosur for the international leadership trip. And, you know, so you have to go through the domestic program and graduate before you're even eligible for some of these international things. But, you know, I've done some international trips. I've been to Cuba. Not many Americans can say they've been to Cuba. I went to Cuba because of the leadership program, yeah. You know, and And I've never been to Uruguay. I've been to Argentina and Brazil, but I'll go to Uruguay because of the leadership program. But then the relationships, you know, when there's an issue, I know who to call. I know, you know, if I don't know the answer or don't know the process, there is someone in the industry that I can pick up the phone and call. And it's probably because I have either met them in the leadership program or they came through the leadership program. Mm-hmm. Most people, I would say, that go through that leadership program have a similar experience that I did, where it draws you in, it solidifies you, especially for an outsider like me that had no connection to Rice growing up. But then all of a sudden they find themselves in the Rice business. And and again, it, the culture just kind of takes you in. Then those are those lifelong contributors to the industry. So
absolutely.
I would just say apply. I mean, it's very competitive. I tell people that I have encouraged to apply over the last 20 years, look, you got to start applying because the chances of you getting accepted the first time out, you know, are slim. I would say very few people get accepted the first time. It's very, very competitive. But it has been life-changing for me in terms of my career. I can't put a dollar value on what it has meant over the course now of 20 plus years.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. It was a game changer for me. I was very young when I went through, so had no idea really what I was signing up for, but wow, what an experience. And then, because I was in the last class that was 1 year, so we did it all in 1 year, where now you do it in 2 years. And, you know, there's an argument out kind of now and kind of post-COVID that, you know, you can get everything you need off of the internet. You can learn everything you need to learn off of the internet. But the face-to-face, the conversations in the van, like you say, the offsite, it's not just the meetings. It is the connections that you make with other farmers, other industry people. And I'm sure this is true of any industry, but the rice industry is extremely close. You and I both could probably pick up the phone in the next 30 minutes and call a rice farmer from every rice state, a miller from every rice state, and have a good, worthwhile conversation with them, most likely due to us going through the leadership program and having that experience. And so anybody out there who's in that range, I think the age range is 25 to 45, producer or an industry person, apply, like Tim says. Just start applying, and then your name will get called, and you will have a wonderful experience to draw from for the rest of your life. So,
no doubt. Absolutely.
And I'm really jealous about that international trip. I was really thinking I might pull this one off, but it's just right at the heels of our specialty soybean harvest, and where is it? Uruguay, Brazil, and Argentina?
Yeah. So we're going to go down and be able to, you know, go through all of those countries. And like I've said, I've been to Brazil individually or, you know, as a standalone country. And then I've been back to Argentina, but I've never been able to stay and, you know, go through all of that Southern Hemisphere rice area. And, you know, both of my trips to far South America have been great. So I'm really excited. And, you know, I have to put a plug in for Dr. Linscombe. I mean, you know, I went through with Chuck. Chuck was great, you know, but they're different. You know, Chuck had brought a different background than Steve. Mm-hmm. And with Steve's global, you know, experience and relationships and rice, being able to spend time with him, it is a very unique thing. And so Steve's been, you know, interacting and working with these folks from South America for years. So I'm really excited about the trip and then him being involved in it as well.
Well, Dr. Linscombe was in my class as a classmate. Okay. And so I keep telling him that I want to go on the international trip so I can go with him as my leader, you know.
Right.
And this will be a good one. Maybe I'll make it before he retires, but I don't know that he'll ever retire. He's steadfast in the rice industry for us. Thank goodness. What a huge contributor.
No doubt. Sure.
Well, Tim, I sure do appreciate you spending some time with me today. This has been a great conversation. I've learned a lot. And thank you for all you do and your work in the rice industry.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for being here, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'll see y'all in the field.